This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Reverend Billy Graham marked his 93rd birthday yesterday, and while the world's most famous Protestant preacher has slowed down in recent years, he can still command the spotlight. In a career that spanned more than 60 years, Billy Graham has spoken to millions of people in stadiums around the world, and he has prayed beside every American president since Dwight D. Eisenhower. As voters head to the polls today, we're taking a look at the connections between religion and politics in American life. What happens when religious leaders go too far in pressing their influence in the realm of politics? We'll start with a look at an aspect of Billy Graham's career that caused him great regret, his involvement with President Richard Nixon. Here to talk to us about that is John Elliston. He's an investigative reporter whose latest piece was published by the website Carolina Public Press in Western North Carolina. John Elliston takes a look at newly released documents that provide more details about the relationship between Billy Graham and Richard Nixon. John, welcome to the program.
Hello, Frank.
Of course, we've known for a long time that Billy Graham and President Nixon were close, that it was not just about spirituality. But how was that relationship different than those Graham had with the presidents that preceded Nixon?
The Reverend got closer to Richard Nixon than he did to any prior or subsequent president. And that's a fact that's borne out in a new release of papers from the Nixon Presidential Library. The library released this summer a collection called the Alphabetical File from the Nixon White House. And that is a somewhat authoritative record of most of the contacts between the Nixon administration and Billy Graham. And here we're talking about contacts not just direct contacts between the president and the reverend, but contacts between their subordinates. And what emerges is a new level of detail about just how close these two men were.
And part of that had to do with lessons learned from Graham's crusades and that Nixon brought into his campaign, particularly the idea of advancement.
That's true. One thing I learned in reporting on the story came from a conversation with a longtime Nixon aide, who's little known, but was very important in that he was the president's appointment secretary. His name is Dwight Chapin. And what Chapin would do was arrange contacts between the president and the reverend. And Chapin told me that, in fact, the ties between the two men went back to the Eisenhower years. Again, something that we've known for a while. But more importantly, that in 1960, while then Vice President Nixon was making his run for the White House, he cultivated a superb team of advance men, these campaign operatives who would go to a new town in advance, set up pre-publicity and contacts and what have you. The manual for the Nixon campaigns, both in 1960, 1968, and 1972, was based largely on lessons learned from the Billy Graham crusade. Reverend Graham's team of advance men had been some of the best in the business, and the Nixon campaigners picked up on those lessons.
And some of the, what's interesting, I guess, to me in reading this about Graham's communication with Nixon's aides, not just the president, but his aides, was the fact that he was really helping out in developing and doing intelligence work, in a sense, on campaign strategy.
That's right. It's true that the men were close personal friends. And it's also true that Reverend Graham went out of his way to minister to the president, to exhort him to indulge his own faith and think about matters of faith. But along the way, Billy Graham made great efforts as well to become a kind of political strategist for President Nixon, and that's borne out in these papers as well.
Interesting document about one of Graham's crusades right here in North Carolina. Took a look at whether or not how the president was doing here. Billy Graham met with the Democratic nominee for governor and also commented on Jesse Helms' chances in 1972.
That's right. Late in the campaign in 1972, where President Nixon was running pretty far ahead in the polls, Billy Graham was in his home state of North Carolina and attended church with the gubernatorial candidate Skipper Bowles, who shared some of his own polling data, which indicated that it looked like Nixon was heading for a clear win in North Carolina, as in fact he was, and that a new person on the national scene, Jesse Helms, was likely to pull off a Senate win, which of course he did.
And the Reverend Graham was giving the president great support during his Watergate ordeal, apparently suggesting or feeling that the president was innocent and being hounded by the press and unfairly treated throughout the entire ordeal.
It's true, and we've got to take our minds back to this exceedingly troubled time in American history where we had the Vietnam War, the anti-war protests, urban insurrections of various kinds, the invasion of Cambodia, the Kent State Massacre, and then finally Watergate that kind of sealed the deal for Nixon. Amidst virtually this entire run of troubling events and challenges, Billy Graham stayed close to the president. They distanced somewhat going into Nixon's final year in office, as the president was understandably pretty preoccupied with his problems.
You mentioned Kent State. After that, of course, then that's when the president revealed what had been going on for more than a year, the illegal bombing of Cambodia. That touched off demonstrations on campuses across the country, and there was the slaughter at Kent State. After that, Billy Graham became involved in helping the president try to build his ties, strengthen his ties with young people by asking the president to participate in a crusade. Tell us about that.
Yes, and remarkably quickly. It was, of course, early May of 1970 that the president, well, it was late April that the president announced the bombing of Cambodia. A few days later at Kent State, the National Guard opened fire, killing four students. And the White House quickly went to work to find some manifestation of support among young people in the country. Billy Graham and his staff responded very quickly and informed the president and the White House that they'd be doing a crusade at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, near the end of May. And the president very quickly took Billy up on the offer to come down to Knoxville and speak to a relatively friendly crowd of mostly students at the football stadium in Knoxville. That said, a contingent of anti-war protesters did show up and made a bit of a splash and were ultimately ushered out of the stadium.
Did this raise eyebrows among other clergy at the time, this invitation to participate in the crusade after the death of these students and after the announcement of this the bombing of Cambodia?
Well, Cambodia, yes, and then more broadly the Vietnam War caused more liberal clergy and leaders of faith to publicly challenge Billy Graham and say, you've become the chaplain to a man who's prosecuting a sizable war against a very small country, and it runs counter to what we believe are the traditions of our Christian faith. And Billy was quite aware of this debate, and he didn't shirk it. He engaged it, but it was a very difficult thing to manage, particularly as the war deepened and broadened.
Billy Graham was also involved in President Nixon's foreign policy as well. What did you learn about that aspect of their relationship?
Well, we've known for a while that Reverend Graham was something like an informal emissary of the president. This new collection of files just backs that up even more. What we find are details about how Graham served as a liaison with foreign leaders from Israel and Taiwan, France, Liberia, Japan, etc. Every time during the Nixon years that Graham would go abroad, he was in touch with the Nixon White House about foreign policy aims, about who he might talk to, and consequently, some of these new files go all the way to the upper echelons of the State Department and the National Security Council, where they discussed how best to employ Graham as a goodwill ambassador and also as someone who could speak privately with foreign leaders in hot spots and report back to the White House.
Now, Billy Graham since has gone to some length to distance himself from the president, saying particularly with regard to Watergate, he felt like a sheep led to slaughter, that he didn't realize that all this was going on. He thought the president was indeed innocent. When he found out, then he broke his relationship. Was there anything that you found that suggested otherwise, that he may have known more than he was letting on?
Well, the best testimony I got on this, again, was from the Nixon aide Dwight Chapin, who served as an interface between the two men on many occasions. And he, like many other Nixon administration staffers, feels very strongly that Billy Graham was a fully witting participant in all of these episodes, which is to say that they corresponded with him so much, they spoke with him so much, he had so much face time with the president and time on the telephone that they find it hard to believe that he didn't understand the role he was playing. That said, the Reverend can be, I'm sympathetic with his idea that he was seen as more of a political operative than even he realized, because there was this subtext of White House memos where they would discuss how best we can use the Reverend and his political and religious ties that probably went a step beyond what even Graham realized.
And none of this suggests that while he may have been a witting participant in political strategy, he may certainly not have known all that we've come to learn about Nixon's personal involvement in the illegal activities that went on during his presidency.
That's absolutely true. It would have been hard for any friend of the president to know. Indeed, only a handful of top White House aides knew the full extent of the criminal conspiracies. And frankly, that's not a topic that came up much between the Reverend and the president. They were speaking more proactively about more positive things most of the time. Though we should note, and it's been reported before, that some of their conversations took a very dark turn.
We are going to talk more about this with my guest, John Elliston, an investigative reporter whose latest story on the Reverend Billy Graham appears on the website Carolina Public Press, which you can find at carolinapublicpress.org. Our conversation continues, and then we'll broaden the scope a bit and take a look at religion and politics in the U.S., talking about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the connection between politics and religion in American life, we've been talking with investigative reporter John Elliston, and a reporter whose latest piece on the Reverend Billy Graham and President Nixon was published by the website Carolina Public Press. You can find it at carolinapublicpress.org. John, you're not a Billy Graham expert. What's your background in examining archival material like this?
Well, I'd like to think of myself as an investigative historian, which is to say that most of my favorite work delves into the history of events, usually in North Carolina and usually dating from the Civil Rights era. And I've been doing that for some time. And when the Nixon Library released this new tranche of documents this summer, I couldn't help myself. So I went to California to Yorba Linda to go see this new batch of files. And it, like any presidential library, is an extraordinary facility. They take very good care of you. And it's a joy to weed through boxes of files that have been held secret for decades.
And that is the DNA of an investigative reporter, to say it is a joy to weed through boxes of documents. and why is it important? Because these are new documents in some ways, but and yet, as we've said a couple of times during this discussion, a lot of this we've already known. Why is it important to go through the next batch of newly released documents?
Well, the Nixon materials are sort of the gift that keeps on giving for investigative reporters, because the administration was so laced with scandal, and because it was in power at such a fascinating time in American history, every new release tells us something new about the president and his associates. By way of important example, 2 days from now, the Nixon Library will release, finally, the grand jury testimony of Richard Nixon himself before the Watergate grand jury. So what we're talking about today will probably pale in comparison to what we'll learn in a couple days.
What was the biggest surprise for you?
Well, the biggest surprise in these papers was just how far the Nixon folks would try to employ, how far they'd go to try to employ the Reverend. At one point, it sounds fanciful or farcical, but at one point they implored Billy Graham to intercede with his friend who ran the Holiday Inn hotel chain in an effort to get the hotels to post a photograph, a portrait of the first family at every Holiday Inn in the country.
Wow.
And from what the paper trail indicates, the Reverend was patient and polite with the request, but essentially ignored it. In other words, he knew when to say no, or he knew when he could say no and would say no, and he seems to have rebuffed that rather odd and intrusive request.
Well, I want to bring another voice into this conversation now. The Reverend Nancy Petty is the pastor at Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh. She often advocates for social justice as her role as pastor of a progressive congregation. And recently she announced that she was going to stop performing marriage ceremonies at the church. Nancy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about that decision. Why?
My decision to ask my board of deacons to be relieved from signing marriage license is really rooted in a 20-year-old decision of the church that I pastor. 20 years ago, Pullen, as a church, went through a pretty significant discernment process in which they talked about homosexuality and LGBT issues. And at the end of that discernment time, voted and affirmed to welcome gays and lesbians into our congregation, to accept them as full members, and to bless their commitments and their covenants. And so February of next year, we will celebrate the 20th anniversary of that decision. And so within these last 20 years, though, we have made that statement, but we have also continued the practice of separate but equal kind of status, in which we still would marry heterosexuals, participate in the legal aspects of that, of signing marriage license, while denying a portion of our congregation those same rights. And so to me, it felt like we were not fully living into the decision that we had made 20 years ago to say there are no second-class citizens, that we are one people with the same rights and privileges. And it was a growing awareness within me that I could no longer, as the pastor of the church, participate in perpetuating what I feel like are unjust laws of our state by acting as an agent of the state. And so to line up with our theology, who we say we are as a church, and actually put into practice our theology, and with my growing uneasiness of acting as an agent of the state, I ask my congregation to relieve me of my responsibility to sign marriage license, and to in a sense, do what the church is supposed to be doing. And that is to bless the commitments and covenants of anyone who comes to us asking for a blessing of faithful commitments.
What's been the response of the convention? Your congregation, mm-hmm, obviously gave you this permission.
Right.
What about the larger convention of Baptists?
So Pullen is a part of the American Baptist Church USA, and the American Baptist churches are struggling with this issue, and yet they do not have any jurisdiction over us in terms of us making that decision. So in Baptist polity, we have what is called the autonomy of the local church, the autonomy of the local congregation, and so the larger body has not said anything to us yet. And Pullen, as a congregation, they have been extremely supportive of me following my conscience on this issue, but will actually vote in a couple weeks on making a larger statement around marriage equality.
It's interesting because this decision, it seems to me, puts you right in the crux of one of the most often asked questions in American politics today, and that is whether or not religious figures ought to be speaking out on matters that are before the public as political issues.
Right, right. And I get that question a lot, Frank, about how can you as a person of faith, as a minister of the gospel, be so politically active? And I think it's important to note that there is a distinction between church and state issues and religion and politics. And church and state issues are about the institutions and their relationship and the practices that they perform. Religion and politics, though, has to do with how citizens who belong to religious groups are also members of this secular society. And so I think that as a member of this society, as a citizen of this society, I have a responsibility as a person of faith to be involved in the ethical, social, moral issues of our day. And it's a fine line that we have to balance. I think one of the lessons that we learn from Reverend Graham and President Nixon's relationship is that when you become a part of the power structure of an institution, you lose some of your prophetic voice, if not all of your prophetic voice, and your perspective on justice becomes a bit skewed, and you can go really off track with that. And so I think that while we have to be extremely careful around the issue of the church mixing with the state, religious people, in my opinion, have a mandate. At least Christians have a mandate from Jesus to be involved in the social and political structures and networks of our society.
That raises an interesting question. You talked about the prophetic voice, the idea of being over and against the powers that be,
right.
A people in exile in a way. Right. But on the other hand, you would like to win, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you like a world in which gay and lesbian marriage was treated equally and so that it became the law of the land? And you can almost imagine the aspiration of Billy Graham to say, wouldn't it be great if all those things I believe and all the things in this book became the law of the world? Because by my faith, I mean, whether or not you agree with him, you can see from his point of view, that's the way I want the whole world to be. I'm going to link up with this guy and we're going to get there.
Right. And I do think that we have an obligation to be involved in those conversations from our faith convictions, our religious convictions. But when we start trying to enforce those and be willful with those, then I think we've crossed a boundary. I think we have an obligation to give witness to what we think is the truth. But I don't know that that we can remain, that our integrity can remain in that if we, so to speak, become bed partners with the state and with the government in how we look at these social issues.
These questions have long been in tension in the American political life, a God-fearing nation, also a place where freedom of worship is guaranteed. I want to bring into this conversation now Lori Maffley Kipp, who is a professor of religion and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Frank.
It's good to have you here. Give us some historical context for understanding this God-fearing nation that also holds dear freedom of worship. How are these two ideals at conflict from the start, and how is that negotiated from the beginning?
Well, I guess, I think that Reverend Petty has outlined this in a really helpful way, which is to make the distinction between the separation of church and state, which is codified in our, founding documents, and the notion of separating religion from politics, which is not written down anywhere, and in fact has always been a far messier proposition. The kinds of arguments we're seeing today around issues of homosexuality in the church, gay marriage, going back to the civil rights movement and sort of racial issues, are the same kinds of things or parallel to the kinds of things that people were arguing about in the 19th century. What role should churches play in this new nation? And the answer is, maybe it's easy to say in a sense that the answers are always messy and contested, that people are never going to necessarily agree about what the proper role of the church is in society. And that's why initially in the formation of the Constitution, it was actually the rebels from the mainline churches who banded together with other folks to say, look, we can't come up with a common definition, so let's just back off and make sure that no one church is being privileged over any other church.
Well, and to put a point on that, it was precisely because they did want to practice their religion and bring their religion to politics that they didn't want any one church, because they wanted all of those churches and all of their moralities and ethics that went hand in hand with that to be a part of the discussion.
But now some churches, you know, of course, the evangelical churches, for example, Baptists, Methodists in the 19th century, were much more activist about their approach to sort of how to bring about change in society. And this came up over the issue of slavery, the issue of temperance, where, you know, groups actively wanted to try to persuade people, to persuade all Americans, that the best way to have a moral society was to put into effect some of the things that they believed most strongly. And there were other folks, parts of the Episcopal Church, for example, who said, you know, that the role of the church is not to get involved in politics. We're supposed to stand above the everyday political life. Whereas, you know, other folks said, no, in fact, the whole idea of religion is to change society, is to be relevant to the kinds of things that are going on in society. So I present that just as a way of saying there are sort of larger principles that are really difficult to make decisions about and have always been debated.
Well, Nancy Petty, who are some of the models that you look to for guidance as you try to walk that line?
Yeah, I think the obvious one for me is my predecessor, Reverend W.W. Finlater, who was very outspoken during the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, very engaged in the political discussion of what was happening in our world during that time. And I think he set a wonderful standard for how we are to do that as people of faith. Of course, Martin Luther King Jr. is another individual that motivates and inspires me to be involved in these conversations. I think the point is so important to make that when we talk about the church's role in politics, part of that, I think the church definitely has a role, and part of that role is to motivate the people who come to that church on a weekly basis to act out of their conscience, to be involved in the world on a level at which they think is truthful, that represents justice. And so while the church participates, it definitely has a role in it. I think the burden is on the individuals who proclaim to be people of faith to carry the message that they receive, the gospel that they hear in our churches, or hopefully are hearing in our churches, to carry that into the world the six other days of the week and be involved in how we create a just society and a society that has the common good as its priority.
With the understanding, I would guess, and let me ask you about this, when you're talking about religion and higher authorities, the ultimate authority, if you believe in a creator, that's the trump card. So if the creator told you this is right and that is the maker of all that's here, end of argument. That becomes part of the stumbling block, I think, for people who are concerned about religious intervention, involvement, because they feel like, well, the conversation stops because you trumped the argument.
Right. And I think if your angle on religion is to be right, then I think that is a very difficult place for us to try to operate as a society. But if the point is of our religious engagement and our involvement is the respect of all people and the beliefs of other people and how we build relationships around that and understand the motivations coming out of different faith traditions, then we're talking about a different way to live in this world where we respect one another's religious convictions and we find where that common ground is to work on. Every major religion has a version of the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. that would be a marvelous starting place for people to engage in one another around religion and politics.
And it's interesting that you mentioned earlier Martin Luther King, because one of the points in his 10-point pledge that all of the members of the nonviolent movement had to take was that they would not try to be right, that their goal was not to win the argument. You had to promise that,
right.
And that was part of his religious belief.
One of the things I like to say is that when we get into these discussions and debates on issues, it's best if as people of faith, we can reflect what our interest is in them rather than our position. I think taking positions really alienates us from one another as human beings. But if we can share our stories and our interest with one another, why is this issue so important to me? Then we begin to have a different conversation, both in politics and in religion.
We're going to continue this conversation after the break. Take a look at a recent poll that shows 2/3 of Americans are most comfortable with a president who has strong religious beliefs. We'll talk about that and more as our conversation continues with the Reverend Nancy Petty, pastor of Pullen Baptist Church, Lori Maffley Kipp, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC. And I want to say thank you to John Elliston, an investigative reporter whose latest story on the Reverend Billy Graham appears at the website carolinapublicpress.org. You can go there. And by the way, there are links to the original documents, memoranda, and telegrams. It is a fascinating story filled with, as I say, all kinds of original documents. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Our conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about religion and politics. With me in the studio, the Reverend Nancy Petty of Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh. And on the phone, Lori Maffley Kipp, a professor of religious studies, chair of the religion department at UNC Chapel Hill. Lori Maffley Kipp, there's a poll that came out very recently that showed that Americans are very serious about religion when it comes to politics, and 2/3 of them would be uncomfortable with a president who did not have strong religious convictions. What do you make of that?
I think, in part, it's a reflection of the fact that America is, by and large, a religious nation, and religious people tend to associate morality and moral behavior with other people of faith. So it's, I think, difficult for people of faith to imagine being able to act morally without some kind of religious faith to back that up. Now, what's interesting about that, of course, is if you ask other questions, well, you know, would you vote for a Mormon, for example? People back off. So it's not as though, I think, you have to take those polls with sort of a grain of salt, but it's not as though any old faith will do. There are also, people have sort of strong opinions about what constitutes appropriate faith. But I think generally they're more comfortable with someone who can speak some kind of language about a higher power because they associate that with what it means to be a moral person.
And of course, those moralities can be in conflict. Very recently, Nancy Petty, the NAACP of North Carolina, by way of William Barber, the president, wrote a letter that was supportive or in opposition to, I'll characterize it that way, an amendment that will appear on the ballot in May that would make constitutional the illegality of gay marriage. For a long time, black churches, and I think still black churches, oppose gay marriage, would support that amendment. What did it mean to you to see that letter?
Mm-hmm. Well, it meant everything to me, particularly that Reverend Barber is a close mentor of mine and friend and colleague of mine. I think that what Reverend Barber is trying to help us understand, and he does it so well, is that you really have to stay focused on what the issue really is about. And he is so wonderful at doing that. And this marriage amendment that will be on the ballot in May is less about gay marriage and more about codifying discrimination into our state constitution. And regardless of his personal theology or views on gay marriage or homosexuality, he is leading us to try to understand that what is at stake here is something that we all need to be paying attention to, and that is, do we as a state want to write discrimination into our Constitution? And as much as he is helping us as people of faith understand that, I think his prophetic voice is very much needed in this conversation.
And yet he may be pretty close to alone among black preachers mm-hmm. for taking that point of view. That sort of discrimination is conscionable coming from black pulpits these days.
Right. I think, you know, the black church has their own journey with the issue around gay marriage and homosexuality and how they will what their identity will be in that conversation. And I think they the black church needs the space, black ministers need the space to have that conversation with their congregations. And they're doing that. I know ministers in the African American churches in Raleigh and in our area who are very courageously and boldly having those conversations within their church communities. But it is a conversation. It's not something that can just happen overnight and people all of a sudden start thinking about this differently. You need time to do that.
And Lori Maffley Kipp, I know this is something that you've studied, the history of African American churches, and this does point to the complexity and the diversity and the challenge that something like a black church or black churches have faced since before slavery and then in the post-slave era.
Right. I think you've already talked about the fact that there's a different history for black churches, and part of that history included a time during slavery when families were broken up, and one of the responses to that was to almost sort of reinscribe the idea of the patriarchal family, and that became sort of an important touchstone at a certain historical moment. And what that means, I absolutely agree that what that means is that there are sort of long conversations that have to go on and that are going on. That I think, in particular, the AIDS crisis starting in the late 80s and into the 90s, I saw a real sea change within black churches in North Carolina during that time when it wasn't just a matter of some principle about homosexuality or gay marriage. It was, you know, my son's sick, or we're facing, you know, we're having to deal with illness. And at first there was a lot of silence around that, but more and more I think people have started having those conversations. And so, you know, as a historian, I wouldn't say that it's all smooth sailing from here, but I do think that those kinds of issues are starting to come up more. So even, you know, now to generalize about sort of black churches being sort of closed-minded about gay marriage, I think is not true anymore. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of change going on.
This does point to a challenge for churches also, Nancy Petty, and that is you're talking about changing with the times, and I think, Lori, you suggested that as well. As times change, your relationship with your congregation changes, and yet we think of religions as being fundamental. Whether or not you call yourself a fundamentalist, it goes back to the beginning of time and the creation of all things. How do you balance those ideas, that we have to somehow adjust to the times and yet, as you said earlier, be the prophetic voice that stands against the times?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the prophets of long ago, I think sometimes we misunderstand what their role was. We think they were had some crystal ball and was looking way out into the future and trying to say, you know, something that was going to happen. When actually the prophets of the Hebrew scriptures, their role was to discern what was happening at the time and to help people understand what was going on in their culture and in their society and in their faith. And so prophets are interpreters of the time, of the current time, of what is happening now. And so I think that as the church, as a prophetic voice, has a responsibility to help its congregants know what are the issues that our nation is struggling with right now, and how do we address those issues in ways that are faithful?
I want to turn the conversation to current politics and what's going on today on the political scene. And I know that, Laura, you are writing a book on Mormonism. The potential of a Mormon presidential or a Mormon president is unprecedented in our history. Does it have parallels, the Mitt Romney campaign, to John Kennedy's campaign?
Yeah, I think, there have been lots of people have noticed that, and Mitt Romney himself, pointed that out, I think, in his speech a couple of years back about his religious faith when he felt, during the 2008 campaign cycle, felt called upon to address the issue in some way. It's interesting that the difference I notice now, I don't see myself, I'm not Mormon myself, I don't see myself as a defender of Mormonism, but I am a defender of freedom of religion and feel really strongly that it's always easier to defend religions that we agree with than it is to defend religions that we don't agree with. And so part of the challenge for me of writing this book is to say, how can we in a free society sort of tolerate a religion that many people strongly disagree with? How can we find, as Nancy has already said, how can we find points of common interest and points of commonality and keep the conversation going? But I think the difference today is that I see, just in the last few months even, is that Mormons seem to be getting it from all sides. I mean, they've been getting it from the evangelical side, the conservative evangelical side, for a while, but now we have sort of a group of quite adamant atheists who also often use Mormonism as a sort of a convenient stand-in for all religion and say this is just a bad thing for our society and they want to get rid of any talk of religion. But even a lot of liberal folks, Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, for example, talked about, sort of made fun of Mitt Romney's magical underwear and talked about some of the things in Mormonism that seemed odd to her. So it bothers me when there seems to be sort of a piling up or piling on of people from a lot of different perspectives on a tradition that, while I may not believe in it myself, I feel it's important to defend their right.
Have you been able to discern historically what makes the difference in the public's view between something that may – I mean, all religions make outlandish claims that someone can die and come back 3 days later and walk the earth –
right.
Is an outlandish claim. And so in some sense, every religion has kind of extreme views that are difficult for people to perceive. What makes it different for the Mormons than evangelicals in general, who are very deeply convicted and make statements that, to the outside observer might seem extreme? When do we accept and when do we call a religion extreme?
That's a great question. I think people have been trying to figure that out for a long time. Why is it that from the very first moment the Mormons just came in for such criticism? And, a lot of it had to do with their own history. The idea of polygamy in the 19th century was something that most Americans just were not willing to accept and saw as barbaric and wanted to outlaw. But even today, when, most Mormons in the U.S. look pretty darned patriotic, who looks more sort of all-American than someone like Mitt Romney, there's still... I think for historical reasons, sort of a sense that there's something hidden. There's something secret. And the fact is, there are temples where ceremonies are performed that outsiders are not allowed to see. And Americans don't like this idea of secrecy. I mean, I'm really sort of fascinated by this notion of secrecy and what do we consider private and what do we consider unacceptably secret.
Hmm.
And for us, the temple, the Mormon temple, seems to be something threatening to other people. Whereas, we wouldn't ask people to go look in everyone's bedroom to see what they're doing on a regular basis, and that's considered private, not secret. So how do we make those distinctions, and what does that mean? There's something, the temple ceremonies, I think, are still a real sticking point for a lot of people.
Nancy?
Laurie, I think you make a good point around the secrecy. I also think that typically what we tend to fear are places where we are different and we don't understand why someone else is the way they are or do what they do. And so one of the things that I think is really important, both in religion and politics, is that we begin to build relationships with one another. And when we can build relationships with one another and get to know someone who is different from us, then we are closer than to being able to understand. We still may have disagreements. We will have disagreements. We are diverse people. But I do think that kind of countering that secrecy and what we fear in one another when we see a difference is if we can start building relationships with people who look different from us, dress different from us, hold different views, both faith convictions and political convictions from us.
Yeah, it means
that's a great point.
Yeah, and keeping the conversation going, even when you know, in quotes, that you're right. You know, we have just a few minutes left, but I want to. Jim Neal has called in and wants to make a comment. I want to get him in quickly. Jim Neal, Jr., North Carolina Democrat, businessman and investment banker, who was a candidate in the Democratic primary in the U.S. Senate in 2008 for the seat occupied at that time by Elizabeth Dole. He lives in Chapel Hill. Jim, welcome to the program. Jim? And that's how quickly that conversation went. Sorry, we didn't have that. Well, I do want to follow up on that as well. Lori, is there something about the fact that so many of our debates and so much of the politics in this country anyway, so much is rooted in religion that makes it difficult for us to do what Nancy just suggested we do, which is build relationships and put right or wrong in second place, second to the relationship between someone who appears to be other? Is it harder to do because religion is so fundamental and so deeply embedded in American politics?
It is. And, religion is something that there's a lot of fear people have around people that are different religiously from them. Even I have colleagues at who teach in other departments at UNC who will say to me, I don't understand how you can teach a course in religious studies, because what if someone brings up their beliefs? What do you do? And there's sort of a terror around the idea that people are going to have strong convictions about something that you'll have to face. And as Nancy was saying, relationships are built on trust, and it's sometimes hard to trust people, especially when you've heard things about them or their people that are scary to you. So when I teach my course in Mormonism at UNC, I always have a sort of large number of students who come in saying, I've heard these things about Mormons, that they're a cult, that they do strange things, but I know this really nice person who's Mormon, and I can't figure out how to put those things together. And so the process of putting those things together and of making something a little less scary so that you can at least talk about it and build a relationship is, I think, critical to that.
And starts with those personal relationships. Wish we had more time, but I want to thank you both. The Reverend Nancy E. Pullen is pastor of Pullen Baptist Church in Raleigh. Lori Maffley Kipp is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can find a link to a calendar of events mentioned on the program. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Ginny Mueller is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.